I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is a Dartmouth political science professor, Brendan Nyhan, and he has written and been interviewed extensively about how journalists and others should look at particularly Donald Trump's violation of modern norms of democratic discourse. He says that I don't think journalists should give up on or refrain from fact-checking when the president-elect of the United States says something that's false. It's critical to set the record straight, especially when it's about a consequential policy issue. At the same time, journalists obviously run the risk of being manipulated to chase various shiny objects and steer the debate toward topics that the president-elect would like to focus on and away from the ones that he would like to avoid. We're going to be talking about this issue this hour of the program with Professor Nyhan, and welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. He thinks that slow disappearance of various norms can damage our democracy when we are not paying attention, and that each norm that falls is one fewer safeguard against executive overreach than we had before. Even if we never become an authoritarian state, our governance will suffer as a result. Professor Nyhan, thank you very much for being with us today. Hello.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Hi, yeah, it's great to have you here. So what's not normal?
Well, where do we start? There's a long list, but judging by your intro, it sounds like you want to talk about the issue of the accuracy of the statements that President-elect Trump has made. So I'm happy to start there.
Okay, sure.
If that's what you're interested in.
Sure, I'm interested in it.
So we've always had politicians who lie, who take liberties with the truth, who spin. There's nothing new about that. Every politician does that. But Donald Trump is different. He's gone further than any presidential candidate in memory in his utter lack of disregard, his utter disregard for the truth, his utter lack of concern with making accurate statements or even maintaining consistency with his past statements. He's claimed without any basis that millions of illegal votes were cast for Hillary Clinton most recently. And the list goes on and on. When people have tried to catalog how many things he says that are false or unsupported, they can't keep up. He's overwhelming the media with the volume of inaccuracy that he's putting out. And that has real democratic consequences, I think.
Mm-hmm. So let's take one of those statements recently, that millions of people voted illegally in the last election. How did the press treat that? What was a responsible way for the press to treat that falsehood?
Well, The worst case scenario, the one that I worry about the most, is the case when the media simply amplifies the misinformation. They say, Trump, colon, millions of illegal votes cast. Mm. Right? We saw headlines like that. And in that case, the media is just amplifying the false claim. They're repeating it without context or critical evaluation to the public, which may then infer from that statement that, in fact, millions of illegal votes were cast, even though there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that's the case. There were some other stories that were better, but used phrases like "without evidence," which I think still reflects an inadequate lack of judgment about what we know about that claim. We know that it's almost surely false, and that I think it's better to use claims like to use descriptions like baseless or unsupported or even false. There's just no evidence of millions of legal votes being cast, and it's important to defend the norm that politicians should be held to account when they make false statements, and to provide that information to readers in a form that they can understand, even if they just glance at the newspaper or walk by the cable television news screen.
Mm-hmm. There have been a lot of such statements, though. We look at the number of jobs that he saved at Carrier, and indeed he should be given credit for saving some jobs, but inflating those numbers and then being called out on that with a factual statement about how many jobs would be staying, and then tweeting to the union leader who said what the actual fact here was. It seems as though you could be constantly constantly saying this isn't true when you look at the number of statements that he has made. So what do you do about that?
Well, this is a real dilemma. I think every media institution in the country is grappling with this question. There's a temptation to kind of play whack-a-mole, to chase every false statement, and in the process fail to focus on the most important events of the day, or cause people to kind of give up and say, well, I can't make sense of any of this. In a lot of cases, the media are going to have to make choices about which sorts of claims get the most scrutiny, which are the most relevant to policy, which are likely to have an effect on most people's lives. And in some cases, it may simply be better to leave aside a claim that is of little consequence rather than devoting all of your resources to fact-checking in great detail every claim that Trump makes, because so many of them are false. I think, you know, at some point the coverage has to shift to covering to focusing on the pattern of misstatements over time. That's the real news here, not any individual misstatement of facts, but the fact that the president-elect of the United States so often makes false claims. That's much more important news than any one of these misstatements, which can often be disproved just by entering some information into Google.
Mm-hmm. And he was able to do that. He really started the whole thing with the birther story that was carried on for a number of years in this country. How did the press allow that to be carried on when it was obviously a false story, and yet it was repeated and repeated and repeated?
You know, I think the press was more careful on the birther story than in many of these cases. It was so obviously false. The evidence that Barack Obama was in fact born in this country was overwhelming. There's the short form birth certificate and then the long form birth certificate and two contemporaneous birth announcements published in Hawaiian newspapers at the time he was born. And so there's no way that a conspiracy theory about a fictitious documentation of Obama's birth is even remotely plausible. Right? I don't think the media coverage enabled that directly. That was really a story about anti-Obama folks driving that narrative to friendly audiences and through friendly media outlets. The drumbeat of claims that Obama wasn't born in this country kept up, and too many elites winked and nodded at them. I don't think it was a story about the press, but too many elected officials and other folks kept saying, well, maybe there's something to this. I'm not really sure if he was born in this country. And it became a kind of way to express a discomfort with Obama or to question his legitimacy as president. And, as you said, Donald Trump rode that very effectively, and he learned from that. He learned that he wasn't going to pay much of a political cost for saying things that lacked any basis in fact, and indeed it would aid his political ascendancy. There's a video of him talking about what a great issue this was for him, very explicitly.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this very major story of Russian hacking, which is an incredibly serious issue in this country right now. He has tweeted, he tweets frequently, unless you catch hackers in the act, it's very hard to determine who was doing the hacking. Why wasn't this brought up before the election? He's tweeted a couple other things about this. This is really of serious consequence to our country. And I'm wondering what you make of a tweet like that and his other tweets that say that the story is, ridiculous, and then somebody on the team saying that the whole thing was planted by the Clinton administration. It's a really big issue here that Americans, be they Republican or Democratic, I'm sure would like to know what the truth is.
This is a difficult one. The national intelligence community has told us that there's a consensus, not just that Russia attempted to interfere in our elections, but that they were trying to do so with the aim of assisting in Trump's election. That doesn't mean they were responsible for his election, but
right. It
does indicate something very serious about foreign interference in our democratic process. That's a very big deal. It's also something that's difficult for us to evaluate the evidence for, precisely because it was a clandestine digital operation, and the way that the intelligence community investigated what happened may itself be classified and or implicate sources and methods that they may not want to reveal. So it's difficult to fully air this out in public. At the same time, though, I do think that there's a worrisome pattern, and that is Trump questioning and delegitimizing different kinds of knowledge-producing institutions, right? So not just the media, but in this case, the intelligence community as well. The intelligence community tries very hard to be nonpartisan. They want to be of service to whomever is occupying the White House to help defend the national interests of the United States. And they want, and in that goal, they hope that the president-elect will listen to them. They don't have to accept every conclusion that the intelligence community comes to, but that they'll consider the evidence as dispassionately as possible and use it to inform their decisions and judgments.
Mm-hmm. He so far has, well, he's not attending the briefing meetings here and has kind of poo-pooed this major information that has come to him. You have talked about how people thought he was going to pivot in the general election and then in the general election kept behaving the same way. I'm just wondering what the consequences are of a president who is not listening to the national security community, who are bringing forward, and maybe some of them will not be really factual ideas or their ideas about what's happening in the world, but certainly they're going to be important issues that will be brought to his attention. How can you have this disconnect between a president and the national security community, which is huge in this country?
It's a real concern. You know, the president's daily brief and the broader process of helping bring a president up to speed on foreign policy is an important one, obviously, for the national security of this country. Trump lacks a deep background in foreign policy or government at all. Of course, he's never held elected office, and we haven't had a president with such a limited background in foreign policy, in decades, if ever. So this, you know, the president's daily brief and the broader process of bringing them up to bring him up to speed is an important one, especially because his national security advisor, Michael Flynn, is not seen as somebody who would be a good information broker. That's typically the role of that national security advisor, is to bring together information from different sources within the national security bureaucracy to the president in a way that helps them reach informed judgments. Instead, we have a national security advisor who himself promotes conspiracy theories and false information. So that's deeply concerning when you have a president who's underbriefed and a national security advisor who doesn't appear adequately suited to the role that's especially crucial with a president-elect with that limited experience.
And does it translate, because of the positions of these people, that the American people thus will also believe in conspiracy theories?
You know, it depends. Certainly, President-elect Trump has a lot of influence over people who support him, right? So there are lots of people. It depends who you're talking about, of course. So there are some things that Trump said during the campaign where Democrats actually moved in the opposite direction. They said, if Trump's for it, I'm against it, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
He can't persuade everybody, but for his supporters, at least, it's possible to promote conspiracy theories and attract widespread belief and allegiance among his supporters. So take that claim about millions of illegal votes being made earlier. There are already widespread misperceptions of extensive voter fraud in the United States that are not backed by credible evidence. We know that to be true from previous surveys. When the president-elect of the United States says that millions of illegal votes were cast, which is a kind of conspiracy theory lacking any basis in evidence, as we talked about, then people who are inclined to believe him may adopt that view as well. And in that way, we may have this conspiracy theory calling into question the legitimacy of our electoral process itself, which is in some ways one of the crucial foundations of our democracy.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that we're not getting, and I'm wondering how you think this will play out. Evidently today, government agency told him that he was going to have to sell his Washington hotel because of the really constitutional conflicts here and his having a terrible number of conflicts of interest, maybe more than we know, because we don't know very much about what his interests are around the world. Are we going to learn what those interests are? Is it important that we learn them? And how? And do you think that will come forward during the whole confirmation of his cabinet members' hearings?
There's no indication that it will come forward in the confirmation process. The confirmation process will force his nominees to make disclosures to the Senate as part of being vetted, but that doesn't encompass Trump himself. And so this the unprecedented deviation from previous norms across both parties for how the president should insulate themselves from conflicts of interest is a major concern going forward. And again, I want to be really clear about the points that I'm making. These are points about which there was no previous partisan divide.
Right.
Trump goes beyond any previous president in his disregard for the facts, and he goes beyond any previous president, at least in the modern period, in terms of his absolute disregard for concern about conflicts of interest. And in fact, he may be, according to many legal scholars, in violation of what's called the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution itself on the day he takes office. Right. So foreign governments can pay for space in his Washington hotel, like, for instance, to rent banquet rooms and things that goes directly to him. Right? And this clause in the Constitution was expressly created to prevent foreign governments from directing payments to public officials in the federal government. So this is a deeply serious concern. And again, one which there was no partisan disagreement about prior to Trump. And it's remarkable that we're even talking about the issue. Again, many people took Trump at his word when he said he would address these issues and made vague promises of that sort in the past. But there's been no adequate effort to address these issues, according to virtually every government ethics expert and watchdog out there. Most recently, he postponed his planned press conference where he said he would address these issues until January, and instead met with Kanye West the next morning at Trump Tower. So this is not something that's being taken seriously or being addressed.
Mm-hmm. Is it by any Republicans? You need a bipartisan addressing, I would think, of these issues. Do you see some? I know there are a few Republicans who are looking at the Russian hacking issue pretty seriously. What about these other potential conflicts of interest? Do you see some saying this is not quite normal? We need a bipartisan investigation.
Very few, very few. I would say the Russia issue is the first one where we've seen some signs of a bipartisan approach to oversight and scrutiny of these norm violations on the part of the president-elect. I haven't seen the same signs of scrutiny on conflicts of interest. And that's troubling in part because the conflict of interest issue intersects with the Russia issue. We don't actually even know the scope of the potential conflicts of interest that President-elect Trump faces because we don't know the extent of his holdings. He never disclosed his tax returns, as all recent nominees have done. And so we can't assess the extent to which his fortunes are tied up with money from Russian sources.
Mm-hmm.
So that Russia connection specifically is of great concern given the interference that we seem to have suffered during the election, and we can't even assess the scope of it because of the lack of disclosure.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Nyhan, about half the people who voted in this election did vote for Donald Trump. Do you think that those voters could have influence over making sure that we get to the bottom of this, or are they not really concerned about an investigation of Russian hacking and some of the other issues you've brought up?
You know, the polling is just starting to take place on this. You know, that Russia issue really started to develop over the weekend, and so it's just starting to register with the public. I think it's too early to say. Certainly during the election, that issue was put on the table. Trump tweeted saying, why wasn't this discussed during the election? But of course it was.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump won the Electoral College anyway. So I hope there will be a more kind of dispassionate reflection on what it means for a foreign country to intervene in our democracy in that way. I don't expect people to change their minds about whether they like Trump or not, but I do think it's important to say that we should preserve these fundamental norms of our democracy. And if you're a Republican, I would just ask you to say, what would you think if this were a Democrat? Or would you want the same Democrat? Would you want the next president, if he or she is a Democrat, to be able to do the same sort of things, to have foreign countries intervene on their behalf, to have conflicts of interest that are undisclosed, where you have to simply trust that they're acting in an ethical way rather than being able to reach an independent judgment. These are fundamental issues to liberal democracy, and they're ones that I just don't think we're taking seriously enough. And instead, people are already growing accustomed to this as the new normal. And I think that's a mistake and a real threat to the kind of democracy that we are and can be.
How did that happen?
Well, it's a long story. We can have this conversation about how Trump became the president-elect. But, you know, I would start in the primaries. I think the Republican Party overwhelmingly opposed Trump, the elected officials. Right. Obviously, he won the party's nomination, but it was unprecedented at how few elected officials endorsed him. They were trying to tell us something. Right. And Donald Trump could win almost no elected officials in the Republican Party to his side. But the party wasn't able to effectively coordinate against him, even though it almost universally opposed him, and instead flailed haphazardly until finally being defeated by Trump as you know, different candidates tried to attack him at various times and failed. And then, you know, unfortunately, you know, once he became the party nominee, then how you felt about Trump was a kind of partisan litmus test. Mm-hmm. And anything that was seen to hurt Trump was seen to help Hillary Clinton. And that made it very hard to have a discussion about these issues that wasn't a kind of zero-sum game for people, where admitting any fault on the part of Trump was seen as aiding Hillary Clinton. And, you know, so at that point, his norm violations just got blurred together in the Democratic Republican divide, and ultimately, Trump basically gets he behaves like a normal Republican in the election, despite these unprecedented norm violations. He gets about 90% of Republicans to vote for him. Now, there's a shift in non-college versus college white voters that was significant, but in general, he looks like a normal candidate. And so, what's striking about the 2016 election is not Trump's performance. It's that he wasn't penalized for these things that make him so abnormal and unusual. He was more like a generic Republican in terms of how people voted for him than you would think, given how abnormal he is in so many ways. And that's left us in this position now where he won the election. The Republican Party would love to enact its legislative agenda. They have unified control of the government. The Republicans in Congress have their voters largely supporting Trump. He has overwhelmingly positive numbers among Republicans. Mm-hmm. And so they're largely going along for the ride. And I just think that is a fundamental concern for the health of our democratic system.
We welcome phone calls. We have many of them coming in. One line is open. Professor Brendan Nyhan is our guest, professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College, contributor to The Upshot at New York Times. His research focuses on misperceptions about politics. He also served as media critic for Columbia Journalism Review and blogs at Brendan Nyhan, BrendanNyhan.com. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're branching into a lot of topics this hour, but we started with President-elect Donald Trump being criticized for making statements that are factually wrong from his recent statements. This election was one of the biggest electoral college landslides in history. The number of people who voted illegally, there's a long list here. How should journalists treat those and the public treat those non-factual statements? Is this a new norm that we're in that needs to be covered in some way? We welcome your thoughts. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to some phone calls. Matt in Madison is our first caller for you. Hi, Matt.
Hello. With regard to your last guest, just one quick suggestion, perhaps. One of the final questions that I heard was how did we wind up here, sort of. And what's a potential solution? I'm not sure if you're familiar with the author Aldous Huxley.
Sure.
There's a few speeches that are available on YouTube where Huxley is addressing different audiences at, you know, Berkeley or MIT, whatever. And there are some very, very interesting theories and thoughts that he lays out during these discussions that I think are extremely appropriate and to the point with regard to how we sort of wound up here and what we may be able to do to turn it back in the other direction. And it really has nothing to do with who the president is right now or who it will be. It has more to do with a logic-based and rationale-based type of thought processes within people and not being so stimulated emotionally so quickly by things like Twitter and
right.
other propaganda machines, so to speak. Huxley's work is, I think, very, very relevant to what is going on today, even though much of it was in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. Professor Nine, should we be reading Huxley?
I haven't read any Huxley in a long time, so I'll defer comment on that part. I do think that, let me just identify one point in the caller's comment that might be worth talking about, and that's the way that Trump does appeal to people's emotions. One concern we often have in democracy is that politicians will appeal to people using their emotions rather than on the basis of facts and reason arguments. You know, politics always has passion. It always has emotion. It can't be divorced from those things. But Trump has taken those emotions to a very dark place, right? So leading crowds and cheers of lock her up is a kind of politically motivated mob mentality that we haven't seen before. And that's very dangerous. I mean, you could see last night
in Trump's so-called
thank you rally, right? That the crowd was still cheering lock her up, even though the election is over. And Trump even seemed surprised at the fact that this hadn't gone away after the election, that he had stirred something up that he was having trouble containing, right? And just to be clear, the idea of locking up your political opponent is a characteristic of non-democratic regimes that we never want to emulate. Yet another norm violation that Trump committed was endorsing that, making that statement that to Hillary Clinton, that she would be in jail if he were president, and then arrogating to himself the power to decline to prosecute her after the election, which was itself a kind of norm violation. It is not the president's decision whom to prosecute under the norms of our system. So the emotions that are being stirred up here, I think, are potent ones. And, we count on politicians observing some lines, right? The political system works not just by laws, but by customs and rules that are unwritten. And Trump has stepped over almost all of those in a way that I'm staggered to see. I never expected to see in my lifetime in the United States, and I think it's very troubling.
Here's an email from Sherry. I was wondering if your guest has any knowledge of evangelical Christian leaders who've addressed the concern that Trump routinely disregards truth in his statements. I'm a Christian. It deeply bothers me that so many of my faith voted for him despite his being unchristlike regarding the truth, not to mention countless other traits and actions.
You know, I can't say I know specifically. There are certainly many. I do want to make the point that many conservatives share your emailer's concern, whether they're evangelical Christians or they have other kinds of conservative commitments. Right? There are many people out there who've spoken out against Trump, from Evan McMullen, the independent conservative presidential candidate, to David Frum, who's a conservative writer and analyst who served in the Bush White House. There are a number of people who've said this is not acceptable, this is not conservative. But many others haven't. And we've seen in the polls, for instance, that people have flipped in their willingness to say that personal conduct can be disqualifying for a political leader relative to the Clinton years, right? When that was a kind of refrain that we often heard, especially from social conservatives, we've seen a much greater willingness of people to rationalize the kind of behavior that Trump either has known to have done or has been accused of, up to and including multiple women coming forward to accuse him of sexual assault itself, in addition to the unprecedented level of falsehood. So, I don't think this is a partisan or ideological issue. We can have that fight about the standard Democratic and Republican commitments, and that's normal politics. What I'm talking about is a kind of abnormal politics And I think it's one, and I hope it's one that cuts across partisan and ideological lines.
Let's go. Thanks for that message. Let's go next to Philip in Black River Falls. Hi, Philip.
Yes. Well, I guess to understand this whole issue, we need to realize that the American people are not as ignorant as people like to believe. They're not reacting emotionally. Everything that Donald Trump said, I don't support the candidate, but everything that Donald Trump said was a devil's advocate of everything that other presidential candidates have done and said and used. Your speaker there just referenced the thing about morality. But as far as this Russian issue, So focus on the devil's advocate of the outrageous things he said. But the thing about Russia is that what did they do? We hear that they hacked the election. How did they actually affect it? Let's have some truth and facts of what they did. How did they really affect it? People keep saying that, oh, Russia hacked the election, but directly in the bottom line of the election itself, what did Russia do to affect the outcome of that election?
Well, they spread a lot of, you know, they hacked.
Answer offline.
They hacked into the DNC and to congressional Democrats and spread information that was pretty unflattering to one candidate and not to the other candidate. I don't think there's any evidence that they hacked voting machines, but just the fact that there was a concern that that could have happened and they had the capability of doing that had some people calling for, let's do random sampling of voting machines in this country to make sure that didn't happen. That seems to me to be rather unprecedented, isn't it, Professor?
Yes. And that always struck me as a implausible story. If you know about how decentralized our voting system is, it has many, many flaws, as we've seen. But it would be it would require a remarkably ambitious effort to hack into voting machines at the individual level that are not connected to the internet. It requires very elaborate conspiracy theories. There's no evidence to support that. The fear I have is that actually that, in, you know, so we've had Trump calling the election's legitimacy into question, and then we've had liberals who wanted to believe that Hillary Clinton had won and the election had somehow been stolen from her,
right,
calling the, you know, suggesting the election might have been rigged or hacked as well. And that's fundamentally damaging to our democracy when both sides have people saying this election wasn't legitimate or the results can't be trusted. We depend on the losers in our elections respecting the results. And when people don't trust elections, that can become a question that rather than a certainty. And that's not a place we ever want to get to as a country. If I can address your caller's broader point, though, because I've heard this a lot, I think it's worth noting. The election was so close that we can come up with any number of things that could have made the difference. It would only require something like 100,000 votes in three states to flip the results of the election. So we can say, the Comey letters, the FBI director, for instance, seem to have played an important role. It's possible that the DNC hack and the Podesta hack helped create coverage of the broader email issue that in a way that harmed Hillary Clinton, that it somehow linked in voters' minds back to the private email server, which was really a separate issue, and that all they ended up hearing about her was email and bad things, and that somehow reinforced trust doubts about her character or trust in her. We don't know how much effect that really had. I think the stronger argument is simply that the precedent of a foreign power interfering in our elections is a fundamental concern for our democracy, regardless of whether it was effective and regardless of whether it ultimately decided the result of the election. Do we want that precedent to stand? And do we want to find out even what happened, to conduct a thorough independent investigation to see exactly what happened? Because right now we don't really know. All we have is this intelligence community summary of findings. But what happens in the next election? What happens when the next foreign power decides to intervene? We face some big questions here.
Yeah. And you also, the reports on this, people have covered up what actually happened here, but many of the initial reports said that the Russians also hacked into the RNC. So you would have to think that the Trump campaign would be outspoken about that they'd have information on Donald Trump as well. And if you really want to control American politics in a way, you can use the information that they may have about him. And heavens knows there must be information. If they're doing what they're doing with the Democrats, why not doing with the Republicans, which makes it a truly bipartisan issue and really calls for a strong response from both Democrats and Republicans, from Donald Trump as well. Who knows what they've got?
We have no idea. I mean, you know, I want to be important to be cautious about this. We have no evidence to suggest any sort of blackmail attempt or anything. There's a lot of speculation that goes beyond the evidence. But if you were our intelligence community, I imagine you would be concerned about the idea of foreign intelligence services right. holding potentially damaging information on the president-elect. Now, the RNC has denied that they were hacked. The intelligence community says that the RNC was hacked, according to media reports.
Right.
You know, I am not a computer security expert. I cannot arbitrate that dispute. But I can, you know, we can say from the reporting at least that there's at least a question of whether the RNC was intruded. You know, people have speculated that Trump, the Trump campaign was face intrusions, that even Trump, before he became a presidential candidate, for instance, when he visited Russia, may have been the subject of various kinds of hacking by their intelligence service. So there are a lot of questions here and certainly ones that I imagine people in the intelligence community at least are very worried about.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Philip, for your call. Jake in Oshkosh. Hi.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. I wanted to ask your guest whether he thought Donald Trump was a pathological liar based on my readings of David K. Johnson's extensive biographies with regards to Donald Trump long before he sought the presidency, that he is ultimately a pathological liar.
Professor?
I don't know of a scientific definition of pathological liar, so I'm gonna defer on that point. I'm just going to say that, again, we can only judge Trump by his public statements, and the pattern of inaccuracy there is unprecedented. Whatever psychological basis people want to infer about that is really beyond the scope of my expertise and really beyond the scope of what we can directly see ourselves, right? We can only ultimately judge politicians by what they do and say in public. So I prefer to focus on what Trump says and not speculating about his psychology.
Mm. It would seem to me that the press has a huge task in front of itself for, well, every moment now. This Russian story, it would appear that the New York Times is really at the forefront, and the Post is as well. But the Times had an excellent story on this today, and they will continue their reporting. I'm wondering what is the role in doing investigative work, because I would think that, you know, you'd be able to trace a lot of emails. You know, we've got a whole host of people who have Russian connections who will be in the cabinet now, that you want more information about all of that. A couple questions for you. The responsibility of investigative journalism, if you have a feeling that that will be forthcoming in the next few months, and why it is, and I know some news outlets, ABC evidently led their news last night with Kanye West appearing at Trump Tower instead of the whole Russian hacking story, which certainly was the story of the day. This wanting to present stuff that will take our minds off everything, and this real need to have some incredibly solid journalism that is a truth-finding journalism.
I think there's a dilemma that media organizations face between their responsibilities to our democracy and their commercial incentives. The news about Trump is often depressing. It's going to be interpreted as biased or partisan, regardless of whether that's the intent or the actual content. It's much easier to present clickbaity stories, of which Trump generates a kind of reality show style drama every day. Mm-hmm. Right. So those stories are almost being written for you. Right. Kanye West was at Trump Tower. Jim Brown was at Trump Tower. You know, here's Carly Fiorina being interviewed and talking about how she looked at Shaquille O'Neal's shoe when she was in Trump's office. None of this amounts to anything substantively,
right.
But it creates a lot of easy to produce and report on content, right? The deep investigative reporting that's required for such a non-transparent, what appears to be a non-transparent transition, and what appears to be it's going to be a non-transparent presidency, is expensive and slow, right? And so it's hard for media organizations to invest in that kind of reporting, but it's going to be critical. It's also going to be critical because this administration has shown signs of being more hostile toward the press than any in recent memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say that the Obama administration and Bush administration were very frustrating to the media. But Trump has gone to do lengths, leading crowds in ritualistic booing of the media at his rallies, barring certain news organizations
right.
from even covering his rallies from the official media section, claiming that the news cameras wouldn't pan to show his crowd when that actually was a negotiated agreement with the pool that was covering him. He hasn't held a press conference since July. He's an unprecedented amount of time without a press conference. So the media is going to face fundamental access challenges in this administration as well, which means, again, it's going to have to focus on these kind of outsider style tactics like investigations. Even if you do get to talk to someone close to Trump, it's not clear if they're going to tell you the truth or if they're going to honor what they told you the next day. So that kind of coverage, which is often overrated, I think will be even more overrated in this administration.
More phone calls momentarily. Professor Brendan Nyhan is our guest this hour, professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College, contributor to The Upshot at The New York Times. And we're welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655 on the Ideas Network. Let's go to Lee in Williams Bay. Hi, Lee.
Oh, hi, Kathleen. I just find Trump is truly disgusting and frightening to me. And I do believe we need to see his tax returns to fully understand his willings and dealings within the world. And I see many, many conflicts of interest. And I think we're going to need to impeach Donald sooner than later. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
All right. Are we going to find out about his conflicts of interest? There's a call for that. Will that happen, do you think?
Well, I'm dubious. Just to remind your listeners, Trump promised to address this issue during the campaign. He was elected. He didn't take any action to address it. Watchdogs began to document the extent of the unprecedented conflicts of interest that Trump would create. He announced then that he would hold a press conference on December 15th, tomorrow, I suppose. Yes, that
yes.
would have where he would announce a plan to address these issues. What was leaked about that plan was deemed inadequate by experts who reviewed it. And then the press conference itself was canceled and a series of stunty events took place, including the meeting with Kanye West and the announcement of his Secretary of State choice. Again, in that move, the media's focus off of this issue, he's now said he's going to address that issue in January, but no date has been set. There's no reason to believe that that is an actual commitment to do anything, certainly before the inauguration. Once Trump's in office, he's arguably going to be in violation of this clause in the Constitution. And by then, it may be a case where people simply shrug and start getting used to that as the new normal. But I don't think we should. Whether anything will be done about it, though, I don't know. I mean, there's, the Republicans in Congress have the leverage over Trump with his nominees requiring confirmation in the Senate and his legislative agenda going forward. They have the majority in both chambers. They're the ones who could put pressure on the president-elect to address these issues and to make the appropriate disclosures and to put his assets in a blind trust or take other steps. And they just haven't made any effort in that direction.
Judith in Wausau. Hi, Judith.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'll try and make this as brief as I can. And I want to preface it by saying I am certainly no fan of conspiracy theories and no fanatic. But during the campaign, especially pre-primary, I found listening to Trump was like listening to a man who was watching a post-apocalyptic dystopian film in his head. Everything was broken. Everything was a disaster, da-da-da-da-da. And he was the only one who could fix it. He kept saying that. He's cast doubt and distrust on the media, on the courts, on the federal government, on you name the target, he's found it. He has also stirred up a great deal of, I would say, fear, hatred, panic, and dread. He's aroused really strong emotions around the country, whether you're pro or anti-Trump. And I can't help but think I am watching a setup, a proto-fascist setup. that I keep thinking of Joseph Goebbels, who said, the bigger the lie, the more readily it's believed, and that the lie will be stuck with in the end, is that I, Donald Trump, am the only one who can fix this, that he'll make us distrust Congress, the Senate. And so I don't know how to solve this, but here's the dilemma, and it's the very question you're discussing. How does the country itself, the people themselves, establish a source of news that the vast majority of people will trust, because he's really devoted himself to sowing distrust?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, thanks, Judith.
Well, I don't think there's any easy way to establish a media organization that everyone will trust. But I do think it's important to make every effort to work from a common set of facts and to provide counterweights to the kinds of disinformation that we've unfortunately seen coming from the president-elect. I don't want to engage in the analogies that your caller is bringing up, but I do think it's fair to say that many experts are more alarmed about a Democratic backsliding and illiberalism than I've ever seen, certainly in my adult lifetime. We've seen observers saying that the crisis facing democracy, not just in the United States, but across the West, is as great as it has been since at least the 1930s. So these are very serious issues. When people come to power saying that they're the only person who can address a grave threat and start threatening to lock up their political opponents, delegitimizing other sources of power, information, the society, et cetera, that's dangerous stuff. It doesn't mean Trump's establishing a dictatorship, but it is very dangerous for a democracy. And it's important for the rest of the democratic system here, Democrats and Republicans, to kick in and make sure that that we stay a democracy and a country governed by the rule of law. I think we can do that, but I'm more concerned than I've been ever in my life.
Let's go to Cindy in Fox Cities. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. I'll just like to quickly say that I think the press should leave the stories like the one with Kanye West going to Trump Tower to the talk show hosts, the late night talk show hosts, the SNL, and really concentrate on the things like the Russian hacking, because that's what really matters.
I guess I would just say to folks out there that they need to vote with their clicks, right? The media organizations can see what people read and what they share. And, people often say they want hard news, but they pick the soft news. So if you want hard news, if you want serious journalism, if you want journalism about serious topics, it's important to invest in that journalism with your time and by sharing it and making sure that the media knows that the public wants that kind of information and not just reality show style coverage.
Right. And a lot of the networks are to blame for some of this, too. I mean, they just turned over, because it was good for ratings to turn over huge amounts of airtime to Donald Trump during the campaign. It was phenomenal. He just got a lot of coverage.
That's right. I think, one factor I failed to mention when we talked about the Republican primaries was Trump's utter dominance of media coverage.
Mm-hmm.
It created just an overwhelming there was no space for other candidates to emerge. The coverage of him was at such a saturation level. CNN in particular would run Trump rallies unedited for
hours.
Yeah. I think in almost every day in August, they were showing all three cable networks were showing Trump rallies at the same time at one point or another during the day.
Brendan, thank you so much for being with us. Join us again. Professor Brendan Nyhan, professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College, contributor to The Upshot at The New York Times. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, to Zeb Gozman, who, as we said last hour, this is his last day as an intern, and we've so enjoyed having him here. And thanks so much to Zeb. All the best to him as he carries on. Tomorrow, we'll be with you again.